This morning we're beginning a quite magnificent book of the Old Testament. I always liked it, the book of Ecclesiastes, because it was questioning and searching and probing and not just accepting. But when I had to study it to write the book and produce these lectures, I got to like it more and more. It's an extraordinarily modern book. I'm sure you're going to find yourself at home with the questions that he's asking about traditional wisdom, which everyone thought was tradition. It's handed down, so people fall into line and live according to that tradition and hand it on to their children in education, and it answers their questions. But Ecclesiastes, the author, Coelet, we'll talk about in a minute, the author is saying, yes, it's only answering your questions because you're not asking them. You're not asking the questions. So you're accepting it as something that you can live by. But when you actually ask the questions and have a look at the traditional wisdom that you've received, it's a bit iffy. But at the same time as he does all that, his foundations are very, very beautiful. Belief in God is the only thing that's going to make meaning to us. So let's enjoy it together. As I say there, it's a penetrating reflection on the nature of true wisdom. In accepting it as inspired, so it's part of a canon of the Jewish Palestinian scriptures, and then into the Christian world as well, Jews and Christians challenge us to listen to the Spirit of God breathing through this work. So the church has, even if whatever, it's got a place, we've got to expect to be some revelation of God happening. The first words, which I have in red, the text itself, the rest is my commentaries, it begins, the words of Qohelet, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Okay, Qohelet. Kahal in Hebrew means the assembly. It's the equivalent of the Greek ecclesia, which then comes into Latin also as ecclesia, meaning church. That's the word we mean for church. So we're dealing with the word meaning an assembly. That's the Greek for Qohelet when they translated ecclesiastes, hence the name of the book that you'll often find in your Bibles, the book of Ecclesiastes. Same word, but Greek rather than Hebrew. Qohelet is quite tricky because Kahal, meaning the assembly, Kohel would be a man of the assembly, a preacher perhaps, a teacher. It's disputed because the word's only used here, so they can't get too much other stuff to clarify it. But in general, it would be, I presume it means a person of the assembly, maybe a teacher. Okay. Kohelet is feminine. So, but it's very clear that this Qohelet comes right in the last words of the, is a male and a man teacher. Why Qohelet is, and the people who study the text go all over the place, that they're just kind of guessing their way through. I've chosen myself in my commentary to suggest that the author, who is male, is using the, and I give no, don't give any credence to this, it's my opinion, but I've drawn it from reading, and that is that he's upsetting wisdom, but he's also upsetting wisdom by having a female talk about it. Like he's coming at it from an unusual angle from the male dominant culture and the writing, reading culture of the day. Well, whatever of that, that's what I've chosen to do without it being in any case, any sense certain of it. Qohelet is called the son of David. So Solomon is never mentioned in the text, but the implications are we're talking about Solomon. Because Solomon is the king in Jerusalem who was noted for his wisdom. As we listen to the reflections of Qohelet, I'm going to call the person speaking to you, Kohelet, but the book Ecclesiastes, so you get a bit of a distinction there. As we listen to the reflections of Kohelet, we are to have before our mind's eye, or I would suggest if it was staged, sitting centre stage, we'd have the man whom traditional wisdom has presented as renowned above all others for his wisdom. The Song of Songs was the Song of Songs of Solomon. You know that. The Proverbs are the Proverbs of Solomon. The Book of Wisdom, which was written in AD while Jesus was alive, is the Wisdom of Solomon. So they're all... Solomon is the key figure when it comes to wisdom literature. So watch him centre stage as you read. I'm reading to you from these texts from the first book of Kings, which we also looked at, by the way, when we looked at the Song of Songs. God gave Solomon very great wisdom, discernment, and breadth of understanding as vast as the sand of the seashore, say the authors writing 600 years later about this idea, legendary Solomon. Again, people came from all nations to hear the wisdom of Solomon. They came from all the kings of the earth who'd heard of his wisdom, says the book of Kings. Yahweh gave Solomon wisdom as he promised him. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. That's enough to show that in the literature of the Old Testament, Solomon is the exemplar of wisdom. Solomon is the exemplar of all the benefits that flow from wisdom as traditionally understood. He was renowned for power, wealth, astonishing success in all that he undertook. And we're watching Solomon, this I hope helps you, reflect back over his life, this very successful, rich, powerful, blessed, wise king, reflecting over his life, and we're challenged to ask ourselves, what did all this wisdom of Solomon really achieve? And when are we writing? Solomon was king of all of this, the whole of Palestine. Judah, after Solomon's death, the rest of them broke away, and Judah was left on its own. It's mostly desert. That's the extent of Judah, right through to the Babylonian captivity. The Judah in which this book is written is this little tiny enclave here as part of a vast Persian empire all over the world. And that's all that's left of that, which is all that's left of that. So what was the legacy really that Solomon left, and how wise was he? The temple in which we're assembling to listen to Kohelet, the temple in which we're assembling was reconstructed from the rabble of Solomon's glorious temple, destroyed in 587. What became of his success as a builder? The cities are all rubble. What about his power and wealth? How wise really is he? Is the question being asked by our author. The author is challenging much of traditional understanding of wisdom. How could he do this in a more dramatic way than by having the great Solomon center stage, recognizing his failure and questioning the wisdom attributed to him? Do you get the feel of it? It's quite dramatically powerful. In asking us to listen to Kohelet, and at the same time to hear the words as coming from Solomon, the author is asking a lot of us. So this is preparing you for a very subtle, quite complex text, and it's often difficult to interpret. So obviously I'm just going to give you my best shot at it, having studied it as best I can. At times, the author uses Kohelet to present his own position. At other times, he presents what we might expect Solomon to have said. So when the text says one thing, don't be sure the author agrees with it. He He may have Solomon saying it in order later to say, do you really think that's true? Do you get it? Mm-hmm. Who's saying it? What does he agree with, etc.? At times he holds up a point of view so that we'll see how ridiculous it is. At other times he undercuts our prejudices with a statement that shocks, perturbs and challenges us today as it did then. We must constantly be on the lookout for irony and paradox. He's a philosopher and a very clever teacher, so watch for that. His critique of traditional wisdom is subtle in its way of questioning and undermining ways of thinking that were part of the accepted understanding of the time. We shouldn't be surprised when we find that he's challenging our assumptions just as radically. I'm sure you, like me, will find a lot in this book to jumpstart our brains to think about our culture, our tradition, our church, the world, etc. Now, what do we know about the political... So this is the answer to your question, Matthew. It's much the same for Song of Songs. What do we know about the political, social and economic environment in Judah in the years 450 to 350, which are probably the years in which this is written? I won't try and defend that statement, but that's probably the time. Okay. Well, it took a long time for post-exilic Yehud. Yehud is the Aramaic word for Judah. And Yehud is Jew, isn't it? And so that's where you get the name. Yehudi. To recover from the devastation of Judah and Jerusalem in the early decades of the 6th century and the depopulation that ensued. People taken off into exile, people fled to Egypt, all over the world. It was in a mess and the population was decimated and took a long time to recover. When some of the exiles returned home from Babylon, beginning in 539 BC, they found it well nigh impossible to get the country functioning again. Trade and commerce were practically non-existent. They had to struggle to meet the tax imposed on them by their Persian overlords. It was only towards the middle of the following century, about 450, that's the period of Nehemiah and Ezra, that things started to improve. However, economically, Yehud was in a very different situation from the subsistence agrarian economy that was the life of their ancestors. Go back before the exile, the Jews, which is the right name for the people living in Judah, they had subsistence farming. Very little trade going on, but it was all economically within the country. Quite simple and quite adequate life. Now it's all changed because they're now part of a vast empire. A life supported by traditional wisdom that encapsulated maxims for the conduct of human life and affairs. So the traditional wisdom that had been handed down may be suited a simple agrarian economy where life was much the same. Just as, if I could make a quick statement, the idea of parish life probably was a marvellous thing where nobody travelled and nobody had cars. I'm not saying it's not a good thing now, but you get the difference. This was the social life of the community, and that was their community. And no one went anywhere else. Very few people travelled. So this is their life, this is their social life, and right in the centre is the church. Beautiful, appropriate, works. How does a parish work in a modern city with travel and people all over the place and grandkids over there and mum here? And you know, it's a very different world we're in. And they were in a very different world when our author is writing than what the Proverbs were saying was a good way to live. A good way to live depends on what your life is. While the presence and action of God in the life of the community is central to our author's thinking, and it is, he's convinced that this presence and action are entirely mysterious and utterly beyond human comprehension. Isn't that still true? And theology can claim too much. Theologians can think they've got it all worked out, can The church can think it's got it all or doesn't think this, but I mean, people can, in the church, think this way. And of course, that can only create atheism because it doesn't work. So the mystery of the transcendent, awe and wonder before something that we can't comprehend, we have some insights into it. But please remember, this author didn't know Jesus, so he didn't have that wonderful help to insight into God that we've been graced with. So it's beyond comprehension, according to our author. He begins his reflections from observations of human behaviour and not from God's revealed will. Very good idea. We should be doing it too. Our theology should be evidence-based. We should be starting from experience, marriage experience, celibate experience, life experience, economic experience. That's where we start, because that's real, and we don't pretend to understand it all. But we don't have abstract theology giving us answers to our life, do we? We can't. It must be grounded in experience, including, by the way, of course, the experience of Jesus, which is a beautiful gift to us. He could see that much that traditionally went under the name of wisdom, and by the way, wisdom, Hebrew chokmah, Greek sophia, they are also feminine gender words. So that may be related to Kohelet as well, being a feminine gender. I'm talking now grammar and rather than. He saw it as outdated and provided little guidance in the changing environment within which he and his contemporaries had to work out their lives. What are other things that the scholars have found out? A lot of this is new too, it's new information because exploration, libraries, a whole lot of stuff's happened in your lifetime and mine, that has advanced our knowledge. Well, this is some of the things we know about the world in which this book emerged. Grants of property, this is the Persian system, were bestowed on individuals who, in exchange, were responsible for collecting taxes. So I'm the Persian king back in Ecbatana or somewhere, and I appoint you, Gloria, to be the tax collector of the locality. And so you've got property, and you go then, you've got the property and you have to collect the taxes from this mob here.
I'm rich.
Good. So those grants were not automatically handed on from father to son. They were not inherited, but were given by the governor to whoever was judged better at raising taxes. That leaves you pretty insecure because you can't have it. Smart property owners, there aren't any here, I know, but were there some here you'd understand. Smart property owners subdivided their properties and extracted tax from their tenant farmers. It doesn't take much imagination to recognise that the system was wide open to exploitation. It offered opportunities, but it was fraught with considerable risks. It is the arbitrariness of the system and the volatility of an economy which was much more dependent on inter-provincial commerce that accounts for much of the advice contained in this book. He's talking to real people living in their real world for whom the wisdom literature was not written, because things are different now. It also accounts for why we moderns find its wisdom much more congenial, I think you will, than a lot of the traditional wisdom of which our author is critical. A text just to back up, well, doesn't exactly prove it, but here's Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 3 to 5. Nehemiah was governor in the middle of the 5th century right through to pretty well the end of the 5th century. He had two periods of governorship. He came from Persia. He was a Jew, but he came back to build the walls of Jerusalem and set the place up basically as a stronger place against Egypt, because they're always trying to build up buffer communities. Okay, so this is what I'm now reading from the text of Nehemiah. We are having to pledge our fields, the whole text. There were those who said, we are having to pledge our fields, our vineyards and our houses to get grain during the famine, writes Nehemiah. There are those who said, we're having to borrow money on our fields and vineyards to pay the king's tax. Now our flesh is the same as that of our kindred. Our children are the same as their children. And yet we are forcing our sons and daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have been ravished. We're powerless. Our fields and vineyards now belong to others. That's the situation in which he's living and in which our author is, Kohelet, is questioning. A man under the name of Chun Leong Siu, I don't know how to pronounce all that, it's Korean anyhow, puts it in his commentary on Ecclesiastes. He writes, the economic environment favoured the political elite and the most influential entrepreneurs. In consequence, the gap between the rich and the dependent classes widened. Do we know anything about that? And I only a couple more pages to from this part of the introduction. The prevailing insecurity and the difficulty of being economically self-sufficient in the new commercial environment that depended on the variability of inter-province trade, globalisation, but on a small scale of the day. They're dependent on what happens in Moab now, they weren't before, and up in Lebanon and in Syria and what the organisation back in Persia wants by way of tax and money. So they're part of a bigger world, and they're not coping too well in it because they're pretty well a backwater of it. They encouraged a mentality that fostered striving to have more, but never feeling secure in having more, and so never being satisfied with what one had. Greed and ambition flourished in this environment. There was a tendency for those who made it to criticise the poor as being responsible for their condition. You ever heard that before? I mean, no wonder we like this book. Well, I like it anyhow. It's up to you to tell what you do or not. The legal system favoured the prosperous, so that justice was elusive. People had to be careful in what they criticised as reports got back to those who exercised power in the land. There was a prevailing fear of the arbitrary powers wielded by the rulers. It was absolutely well known all over the world. I'm talking about Greece, basically, because that was the writing world of that day. The Persian Empire was built on spies. There were spies everywhere. I don't know whether Russia used to be like this under Stalin, but I'm not a Russian expert. But that spying was the big thing. So mum's the word. You don't know who to talk to, and you don't talk to your kids because they'll talk to the teacher. It was they're living in a bit of this general atmosphere of fear. And finally, the author was well aware of the complexities and ambiguities of the human condition. We'll notice him supporting values only to add the rider that we shouldn't expect that the following these values will get you anywhere. He's very realistic. He also offers guidelines, fully aware that they won't always help. He's a good teacher, he's honest. To appreciate the nature and importance of the author's reflections, we need to highlight two underlying limitations, and I'll turn to these in a moment, and this is major. He and his contemporaries took for granted, one, that God controls everything that happens. That's an underlying assumption, unquestioned, all the way through the Old Testament. So you may agree with it, but you may not. But that's an underlying assumption. God's organizing everything. So if Jerusalem gets destroyed, it's because God organized Nebuchadnezzar to destroy it. Why? To punish them for their sin. You got the logic? We might say Jerusalem was destroyed because the Babylonians had a better army, which is not a bad thought. But they put it into the theological sphere. And God is up there pulling all the strings, running everything, organizing birth, death, sickness, failure, wealth, poverty. Whew, sounds exhausting, but God's good at that. But the point is, do you get it? That's the assumption. Everything happened, God's doing it. So, well, if God's doing it, what are we going to do about it? Secondly, death is the end of human life. That's all the way through the Old Testament as well, except when you get right into the Daniel period, the 2nd century BC, Maccabees, Daniel, when they start to think, wait a minute, this doesn't make a sense of what's happening to these people who are getting martyred by the Syrian Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. You've got innocent people dying. Well, God can't be punishing them for their sin. And then other people say, oh, yeah, but it's the sin of their parents. And they think, oh, hang on, this is not making sense. So they started to get the idea that maybe death's not the end. Maybe God's love goes, we don't understand it, but maybe death is just the entry into a new, you get it? That's very new in, well, it didn't exist at this time, and it's very new, even at the time of Jesus, it was disputed. The Sadducees says a lot of rubbish. The Pharisees really believed in it, and Jesus, of course, did too. So this is quite a complex thing. They took it for granted. He takes it for granted. All the way through, death's the end. So you can't get an answer by saying, oh, it's all right when we get to heaven, because there's no heaven. Why were the Jews so strong on this? I've explored this a lot, tried to. I'm beginning to think that probably the main reason was it was something they learned from Egypt. The Egyptians were very strong on the afterlife, weren't they? Mm-hmm. Very strong on that. And this was a reaction to it, because they saw it as necrology, as worshipping the dead and, you know, all this thing. So they, I think it was a reaction against that, that forged their strong sense that death is life. Death it ends with that. But I'm not sure of that. Readers who approach this book, in other words, from a Christian perspective, join others in having serious reservations about the first assumption. At least I've got them, and you may have them. And in the light of the resurrection of Jesus, we see death from a very different perspective, though mysterious. If we're going to learn anything of value from Ecclesiastes, and there's much that we can learn from it, we must listen to it from within the assumptions that were prevalent at the time. So I'm going to now look at with you for 15 minutes or so these two basic assumptions to prove it to you, that they were their assumptions, and that when you read Ecclesiastes, you've got to keep these in mind because they put a limit on the wisdom of this wise teacher, which will have to be opened up if you happen to believe that God doesn't control everything but has actually made us free. And secondly, if you happen to believe that death is not the end, you can see that puts a whole new way of looking at life.